You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am so excited to chat with Nana Adjamine, the founder of Every Stylish Girl. Originally founded in 2016 as an Instagram blog, ESG provides consulting and networking platforms for women of color to connect and build their brands. Through their annual Sip and Slay networking conferences, Nana has provided over 15,000 women with an opportunity to connect with industry professionals in order to take their careers to the next level. This past June, she also launched a new platform, Every Stylish Girl Biz, which offers career counseling, grants, and visibility for local Black-owned businesses, plus their proudest tool, a global directory of over 200 Black and Brown women within fashion and media, built for companies to recruit diverse hires. And she hasn't stopped there. This past June, Nana also launched her very own ebook, Social Media Tips I Wish More People Knew About. And if you're going to take advice on growth strategy and engagement tips from anyone, know that up until recently in Nana's first life, she was one of the social media editors behind New York Magazine's The Cut, aka some of the smartest, wittiest, and most impressive social content on the internet, hands down, no question. She's also been a writer and editor at Refinery29, Elle Magazine, and the New York Times before dedicating herself fully to her own platform, committed to helping women of color get the visibility they deserve. Nana is beyond brilliant, and I am so honored she's here today. Now, on Second Life, it's Nana Adjamine. So, Nana, we like to start at the beginning on this podcast. So, what did you study in school? And more importantly, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
So, since I was young, you know, I always found myself with an undeniable passion to fashion and media, right? I was the child that soaked up Teen Vogue, all the teen magazines plastered on my walls in my bedrooms, all the publications. But also, I grew up in rural Ohio. And I feel like it's a little fun fact a lot of people don't know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, see, no one knows. I was born in New Jersey, spent a lot of time between New Jersey and New York growing up, but then my family relocated to the rural Ohio suburbs where I have like deer and cattle in my backyard.
Wow.
So you can only imagine there's a huge lack of representation for women of color, specifically women who like fashion here. There's like nada here at all. So I kind of always knew that I wanted to study fashion. I wanted to go into media and journalism, but I really struggled with like just where to get a start because most people from my high school here don't do that, right? Or they stay in Ohio and they just like start families after high school. So I was really motivated to leave this rural place and like go into a big city and start working in media and fashion.
Got it. Okay. So how was undergrad?
So this was my first step in like accomplishing that goal of mine of leaving rural Ohio. So immediately I jetted off to Washington, D.C. I have an older sibling who went to George Washington University. Of course, he's in a fraternity. So I went to visit him and I had the best time ever. I was like, oh, yeah, woo, college parties. Like, I can't wait to go to college and I want to go to D.C. because they have amazing Black Greek life here. And there's so much like celebration here. And I love the city. Historically, D.C. is called Chocolate City. As a predominantly Black city of Black educators. So I wanted to be in a place that I knew would support me and I would thrive within. So I immediately wanted to go to George Washington University. And one thing I didn't know is the lack of resources that they had in DC for journalists that wanted to work in fashion. So when I went there, I just really focused on hard news, worked for like BBC, CBS News, and just thought that was going to be my trajectory for a long time, just because there was really no fashion platforms in Washington, DC.
I mean, that's putting it mildly, but let's talk about that BBC job, because you started working there as a contributor, a multimedia contributor, in your last year of undergrad.
Yeah.
What does that job entail? What was that experience like? What were you learning while you were there? And how were you managing to balance that and school? It seems so intense.
It was extremely difficult. It was like, I was like, how am I doing this? Why am I doing this to myself? And so for me, what really motivated me was, one, like, name. And I think with anyone that works in the industry knows how important it is to work with a company with name recognition. So right. I knew the doors that BBC could have potentially opened for me. Also, for those who are listening, I want you guys to know, like, it was very difficult for me to accept this position, because as a graduating senior with student loans, this was an unpaid opportunity. Like, this is so interesting, because I feel like nowadays media internships, opportunities, we really try to make sure like there's some type of stipend, hourly pay, etc. But 5 years ago, that really wasn't a huge requirement.
No.
And so I really struggled with deciding to work at BBC. But one of my mentors at that time told me, you never know what learning opportunity this could lead to. Not every opportunity needs to be a paid opportunity, right? One opportunity could just be a networking opportunity. It could be something you're leveraging. It could be something you're learning. It could be something that helps you build your brand and name in the industry. And I took those words to heart, and I went to BBC, and every single day I pitched a story. They really wanted me to just transcribe all day. But every day I went to my producer and I was like, what do you think about covering this? This was 2016. So this was the first time I had really seen nonstop police brutality in the news. You had Sandra Bland going on at this time, and a lot of other Black lives being taken by police officers on television. And so this was hitting so hard for me, and I really couldn't express how I felt. And I thought the best way to do that was through visual storytelling. So I'd come in one day and pitch to my producer, this is really exhausting on me to constantly transcribe these news about Black lives being taken. Is there any way that I can put it into a video and I can bring students from George Washington universities and professionals to come speak on what is going on in the world right now and how it affects the Black millennial community? And she loved this, because I think this was a moment for Black millennials to speak up and share how this is affecting them. And so I brought in some classmates, did this piece, and it turned into a piece on BBC.com. And I was just so shocked, because I was a little intern slash contributor. And, you know, I came in, they just wanted me to transcribe and like once in a while write up a little story or help the cameraman here and there.
Right.
But to be able to have this opportunity to be published on BBC for something that was so important to my community really was like the kickoff point to my career and me realizing that I wanted to continue to help be a voice for the voiceless. I wanted to continue to really shed a light on Black millennials, what our thoughts were, our ideologies, and like how the news was affecting us, how police brutality was affecting us, and how we continue to still overcome those challenges through our day-to-day lives.
And I have to say, like, as someone who comes from a journalism background myself, the fact that you were pitching every day and not taking no for an answer and not just sticking to the script and transcribing like a good little girl in the corner, I think that is so impressive and so important, because oftentimes I think women, especially young women, don't feel that agency or that sense of power to say like, hey, I have an idea, and then to be able to recover from it when the person says no and to keep pushing, which is what you did, which is just so phenomenal and such an important lesson to learn. You seem to learn it early.
Thanks, Hillary. And one thing I realized that helped me to have that mindset was mentorship. And you speak about a lot of young women not having that urgency. And I think it's just a lack of mentorship. You can't believe how many women I talk to that say to me, well, how did you get a mentor? And they struggle. Yeah. I went to a phenomenal journalism school, and a lot of my mentors came from that, right? And their will and just excitement for journalism. So when they just see like a young budding journalist, they want to support you and help you, whatever that takes. And, you know, I even have had financial support from my mentors, right? And so it's so, so important that young women, young journalists and young professionals are looking out for these mentors, even if they're just digital mentors. And what that means is you don't have to know them personally. You can just listen to their interviews and read about them and really look at what things they took and what skills they took on to help you kind of build your career, if that's something you want something similar to.
I love that. So I also think it's important to point out that while you're finishing your undergrad, while you're working at the BBC, you also started Every Stylish Girl, which has grown into a whole behemoth, but started just as like, I mean, was it an Instagram blog or was it a blog?
Right. No, it was actually an Instagram blog.
Got it. Okay. So let's talk about that. Like, you weren't busy enough. What made you decide to start an Instagram blog? What was the point of Every Stylish Girl? What was your initial intent?
So when I spoke with other women of color on campus and I said to them, where do you go for your news? Literally, like, where do you go for news that speaks to you and speaks to young Black millennial women? They struggled to give me an answer. I mean, like, they were like, Essence, wait, my mom and aunt read Essence. Like, it doesn't really connect to me. Ebony, still not speaking to, like, me and my college experience. And it was that. It was literally getting those responses all the time and realizing, like, there's a gap that needs to be filled in this space. We are not having our voices heard. We are not being spoken to. And so that's why Every Stylish Girl was created, right? Like, we want it to be that space for Black millennial women to get that career advancement, those fashion tips, the beauty tips, relationship and love tips. We want it to be that publication and that source for them. So how it first started, which is so funny, I was really inspired actually by Humans of New York.
Yes. And
I started an Instagram page where I was woman on the street with the camera. Like, I literally was the random woman standing in Georgetown in DC waiting for fashionable Black women to walk by. And I would say, hey, I love your shoes. Can I take a picture? Who's going to say no to that?
No one.
Then a conversation just went from there, right? And I would ask them, can you share your career story? What field do you work in? And I was hearing so many women. They were doctors. They were founders. They were beauty directors, fashion editors. And I would just say, like, there's so much representation in all these professions, from medicine to law to fashion. And we know so little about these women. Mm-hmm. And like, once you know these women are in these fields, you can connect with them. You can network with them. You can leverage through these women. And so I really just wanted to give a space to us and have that representation for us. And Instagram at that time in 2016 just seemed like the best way to get that message out there in a quick way.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. So at what point did you decide to get your master's at Columbia? Because you also did that.
I was one of those strange adults because I didn't want to take a break after college. I wanted to just finish through. I wanted to just keep going. And for me, I had a moment of career transition. So I'd mentioned that I was working at BBC my senior year, but while working at BBC, I just realized I was really unhappy. I was really unhappy by working in hard news. I was really depressed by the coverage, and I wanted to tell stories that empowered me, enlightened me, and were refreshing. And so I decided to transition from hard news to fashion journalism and really focus on women's issues. And so going to journalism school was that support I needed to make that transition, right? Because you couldn't just, hey, Elle, can I work here? Like, I've only worked at hard news. That doesn't work. Like, you need some type of experience. And I only felt like I could really get that experience and live in New York by going to Columbia. So to be honest with you, I went to grad school because I wanted the network and I wanted to live in New York City. And I couldn't afford to just move to New York City on my own. And grad school helped provide the loans that I needed to live there, the community that I needed, the support system I needed. So that's why I kind of went to graduate school right after undergrad.
So did you feel like you got the experience that you wanted? And I ask because for all of our guests who have a post-undergrad degree, I think it's so interesting to hear, like, do you really need an MBA? Do you really need a master's? People have a wide variety of answers, and I'm curious about your experience. Do you feel like that was the right move? Do you feel like you got out of it what you wanted?
I love this question because till this day, people ask me, do you think it's required to go to grad school for journalism? And I would say in general, any higher education, the majority of why people go is the network. And like, network is your net worth. And so I knew going to a school like Columbia Journalism School, where the editor-in-chief at the time of Essence went to, I stalked all these people, I wanted to be like her, right? I wanted to be the next editor-in-chief of a huge publication like Essence at that time. And so I knew if that was the trajectory she took to get her to where she was, I needed to take it. And I will say, because I wanted to find my niche and find my voice in journalism, it was important for me to continue my education. And Columbia allowed me to play around with so many things. In that moment, I discovered that fashion and Black-owned businesses could be a niche, right? And could be something that I would specifically report and speak on. And I didn't know that was even a possibility beforehand. So I was really able to find my voice. I was able to really find what I was most interested in. I was able to report on it because I was in New York City.
Yeah.
Where else would you be able to go to New York Fashion Week and speak to Black models about the scrutiny that they face on the runway, right? Where else would you be able to go and walk to Harlem and talk to hundreds of small Black business owners? And so I really knew like this was such a special opportunity. And I didn't have the pressure of, you know, this is a full-time job. Every story needs to be a hit. To do that, I had a lot of feedback, which I really needed. I had the time that I needed to build out this niche for myself and this voice for myself. And on top of that, my professors were just incredibly brilliant people, right? Like, I got to speak with Nicole Hannah-Jones multiple times when she came to the school. Ta-Nehisi Coates came to our school multiple times. So that's what I mean. Like, I feel like the network was so powerful that I had no regrets on going to grad school.
So you also started writing for a number of publications during this time, including Elle, where you were a freelance writer for a year and a half.
Yes.
Tell me about getting that job. What were some of those first stories and assignments? What was it like?
This job is very close to my heart because this was the first job that really kickstarted my career in fashion journalism. You know, I was able to publish my master's thesis in Elle, which is a phenomenal opportunity to be able to have. And I feel like that right there opened so many doors for me at that point, right? And what I had wrote about was the microaggressions of Black models in the fashion and beauty industry in 2017, which is so interesting how these conversations don't change, and that's something I want to address. Like, we have been speaking about these issues for years.
Right.
And I think, like, two summers ago were when you just saw, like, a wide array of those conversations being publicized through the social sphere. But before that, we have been speaking about it. So I spoke about this in 2017, and this was a major moment because this put together everything that I had been studying in journalism school and was able to bring to a publisher at Elle. And so I photographed the models for this piece myself.
Wow.
I scouted them myself. I put the interview questions together myself. I ran around all of New York finding these women and interviewing them and talking to them and getting them to open up, right? Because a lot of them were like, we don't want certain backlash. We don't want to lose our jobs, etc. They really had to get comfortable with me. And I spent hours on this and months on this, perfecting that and being able to work for Elle at that time and have them trust me at that time to publish this was really mind-changing for me. And it made me feel like my voice wants to be heard in this space and these women are interested in these stories and I want to keep sharing it. And so it was really, really inspiring for me. And it just showed me like, this is what I want to do and I love it. And I could wake up at 3 a.m. and do it. And I did. And all that to say, it was not easy. Like, it was rough. I remember like we had to get all the editors at that time, they wanted the top breaking news stories every day by 7 a.m. And I had class at like 9, so I'd wake up at 6 a.m. and did this Monday through Friday. And it was so exhausting, but it felt good because it was something I was really incredibly passionate about.
So tell me about some of those jobs. So Were you always pitching? Would they assign you things? Did you want to do red carpet reporting? Were you just interested in doing anything they would let you do? What was sort of your sense of work at that moment?
Yeah, so when I had received this fellowship, I was so ecstatic because how it works is that after you do the fellowship, you're most likely granted an opportunity to work as either a contributor after or you get a full-time opportunity there. So going in, I was one of those fellows that were seated in the closet. Shout out to everyone I worked in the closet with at Hearst.
And by the way, just so if anyone doesn't know, I assume that you mean the fashion closet.
Yes, yes. But like, it's actually a closet.
Yeah.
And so one thing that's so fun about fashion really though is like you get to create this tight bond with other fellows and other interns, and then the scenario we're all seated together in like a huge closet, but it made us really close. I love it. And so you're given the regular responsibilities, right? So once again, transcribing, sending breaking news stories, getting coffee, getting mail, opening packages, getting packages, etc. But to each its own. You go in and you tell these editors what you're passionate about, what you want to do, and doors will open for you. And so I am a very vocal person. I always have been, and I love voicing what my interests are. So I remember I went to Christina at this time who hired me. She was the beauty editor. And I told her, I'm like, I'm really passionate about speaking of women of color in this space. I want to do that. And I love red carpet reporting, you know, and I told her this so many times. And she's like, oh, we'll keep you open, keep you open. There was one opportunity for the Elle kicking off Fashion Week, and Elle had a red carpet event. And none of the editors had availability. So they were like, Nana, this is yours, kill it. And I went and I did an amazing job. And so many of their slideshows before, I feel like, didn't have a ray of diversity. And I was able to bring so many women of color, people of color, on that red carpet and interview them. And it was just so beautiful. The piece turned out so beautifully. So after that, I was able to do more and more stories for them. And then when my fellowship ended, I went on to be a contributor, where I wrote mostly about beauty and fashion in the industry. So I think it really goes to just show like what you put in is what you get out. I was consistent, I was direct, and I gave it 1,000% all the time.
So in addition to Elle, you also ended up working for the New York Times. Tell me about that. How did you find that position? What was it like applying? And then was it what you expected?
Hillary, life works in mysterious ways. And, you know, I really am so thankful that I'm such a gregarious person because I think it's helped me get into so many doors. But how this opportunity even fell into my lap is that we had a fall recruitment networking session in grad school. A lot of people, what happens is you meet a recruiter in the fall, you get a job offer, and then right after the spring, you're working. I was really sad because no one offered me a job. And I was like, oh my God, I put in so much work at this networking event. But one thing that kept me going was just the conversations I had with people. So one in particular was this New York Times recruiter that was there, a Black man, and we really connected. You know, I told him about my passions, what I really want to do, and I told him, obviously, everyone's dream is to work for New York Times style section. And yep. So I was just telling him, like, what I love about the style section, what they're doing well. And I said, are you guys hiring? And he's like, no. And also, like, we oftentimes won't hire students right after, or this or this, just all this stuff. And he's like, you know what, but let me take your information because I really enjoyed this conversation with you. If anything changes, I'll keep you in mind. I honestly didn't think much of that because I'm like, that's every recruiter's response.
Right.
So they don't feel bad about talking to you for like 30 minutes. But 6 months later, he remembered me. This was towards graduation, actually. He sent me over an email and he said the styles section is looking for a contributor right now. It's not a full-time position. It's very temp. But he's like, I think this could be an avenue for you. And I remember getting that email and like screaming because I'm like, what? Like, what is New York Times doing in my inbox right now? I'm still a student. Like, what is going on? It wasn't even online. That was the thing. This is why it's so important to cultivate these strong relationships.
And he was just like, can you call me? Let's talk a little bit more about it. And I spoke with him and he's like, to be honest with you, he's like, I don't really understand the role. I'm the recruiter and New York Times Styles, they don't really tell me too much. He's like, I'm going to connect you with someone. And I'm still working at Elle. And I remember emailing the editor at Styles and he never responded. So I was like, is this some type of joke? Are they playing with me? What's going on? And I had, I'm not kidding, I followed up like 3 times and I was like, what is going on? Finally, he responds with, we'll get back to you. That was it. It was like, we'll get back to you. And I was like, oh, crap. I needed this job. What's going on? Finally, he's like, can you come in to the New York Times and meet with the team? And I had maybe 2 interviews just that day. And then I got the job.
Wow.
And one thing he told me is the reason why they hired me. And this is why side hustles are so important. And don't sleep on your daydreams. Is because I had every stylish girl.
Interesting.
So he said, we love that you built such a strong voice on this community. Can you replicate this and bring this to our Twitter for New York Times Fashion and to our Instagram and our Facebook? And I was like, oh my gosh, really? This is what you guys want? He was like, yeah, we love it. And so I came there and I hit the ground running. I was pitching hair braiding stories for the video section for Facebook. This is when they were really trying to push video and experiment with that. Yep. I was pushing this event called Everyday People, where Black people in New York celebrate Blackness and joy together. I pitched that and they took that for the Instagram and I covered that, which was insane, to 2 million people on their Instagram channel. Wow. And then I just was pitching literally every day and I was being their voice on Twitter and on Instagram and was covering Fashion Week. And this was the first time I had like dived into this social realm of journalism and it opened my eyes so much. And it's so funny because I feel like your life and what your career is just becomes more of a niche and more niche and more niche and more niche. And at first it was like, I don't want to do broadcast journalism. I want to do fashion journalism. Then it was like, wait, I want to do digital fashion journalism. And then it becomes, I want to do social media fashion journalism. And this is where I really realized like, okay, this is my passion and social media is what I want to do.
So you ended up leaving that job and moved to Refinery 29 to be a content strategist associate editor. Why that move? What was that experience like for you? And what were you looking to do at Refinery that you couldn't or weren't doing at the New York Times?
Right. So as I had mentioned, the New York Times was a temp role. And unfortunately, during that time was when they had one of their biggest furlough seasons they've had.
Fun.
So, right. It didn't really look good for them to offer any temp a full-time position when they were letting go of people who'd been there for 10 plus years. Right. So once again, I'm going to go back to the topic of creating healthy and strong relationships. An editor at the Times who I would say hi to, honestly, once in a while. And, you know, I would tell her a little bit about my story and how I had just graduated. She really took a liking to me. And one day we're in the bathroom washing our hands and she's like, well, you know, what's next for you after the Times? What do you have in mind? And I was so emotional because I really had nothing in mind. And I'm not kidding. I was like, am I going to like have to move back home to Ohio? Yeah. Because I have no opportunities here in New York. And she's like, you know what? I know a friend at this small company called Refinery 29, and they're really fun, millennial focused. I know that's what you're passionate about. Do you want some type of like introduction there? And I was like, what? Yes, I love Refinery 29. I read so much of their content. Yes, please, I would love an introduction there. And so I remember going into this informational, and it was one director, 2 editors at Refinery 29. And the first thing that they said to me, which I felt was really cold, was, hey, like, we appreciate you being here because someone recommended you to just talk to us. But we just want, you know, right off the bat, like, we have no jobs here for you. And I was like, whoa. And they're like, yeah, we're not hiring. There's no opportunities. Like, but we would love to get to know you more. And I kid you not, by the end of that meeting, they had 2 offers for me.
Interesting.
It's so funny because after she said that to me, it kind of motivated me even more. Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to tell you all the reasons why you want me to work at this company. And I did, right? I showed her my portfolio. I showed her what I had done. I showed her the community I had built. I actually had a YouTube channel at this time where I was doing on-camera reporting myself, recording it, editing it. And I was showing her all of the things I've done, the community I've built, the voice I've built online. And she was like, wait, I think we do want you here. And we're going to find an opportunity for you. So no matter what people tell you in life, no matter how many no's that you get, like, honestly, take that thing with a grain of salt, because you can easily turn that around into an opportunity, which I did.
So tell me about that job. What were your responsibilities? What were you doing? What did you like about it? What did you not like about it?
Yeah, so the simplest form to say what a content strategist does, because this was a whole new arena to me, was that you basically tell the writers what to write about. So you're using Google's algorithm, trending topics, interests during a certain period of time to help the writers on keywords and what their articles should be about. And so that was my job. I would just tell the writers what those keywords were. What I didn't like about that position was that I felt like I worked with a lot of modern Karens. So this just means, like, women who don't understand, specifically white women who don't understand how powerful their words and actions can be to offend a certain group of women, especially Black women. And so that was really challenging for me to grow and to feel liberated and comfortable to be as creative as I wanted, as powerful as I wanted, as interesting as I wanted with my stories, because I felt really limited. I spent a lot of nights sad, crying, trying to pray for, like, my next move. And I think one thing that job taught me was that, like, no matter how frustrated you are, if you can learn something from this, do it, right? If this can help you open doors, do it. And although this was such a tough place for me to work for, I also met the most supportive Black woman I've ever met in my life there, right? Like, women who till this day support every Salish girl and are so brilliant and will do anything to help each other grow. So it definitely had its pros and cons there, but I think one of the biggest pros was, like, the network that I made there and how phenomenal these women are in my life till this day and impactful. But it was definitely a tough place, and I know, like, we all face those in our lives and in our careers where we work somewhere that shows us a different side of us that makes us realize, like, this is not aligned with my values. And one thing I would say about that is, like, if you ever feel uncomfortable in your work environment, it's always okay to speak up. And I was so scared to speak up. It's okay to speak up, and it's okay to leave. Like, I'm telling you, I was so scared to leave. And I realized as soon as I left, my career once again, like, kicked to new levels. So I think it's important, like, if you don't feel comfortable somewhere, like, figure out your next steps and try to make a way for them.
Because that wasn't the right fit for you on a number of levels, do you think that made you even more committed to Every Stylish Girl?
1,000,000,000%.
So let's talk about that. So at the same time, you're still working on your side project, which has now gone from a blog to a full-blown company. You're consulting. Tell me about what key initiatives you were working on during this time, what was working for you, and what wasn't.
So our biggest goal at this time was hosting an in-person community event, a safe space called Sip and Slay. And what this was basically an in-person networking event for women of color to build their brand and to connect. Once again, we felt like there was a space for that in the community that wasn't being fulfilled. So we came in to do that. And it started in 2017, which was right when I was at Refinery, actually. And I think this really motivated me because I felt like this company wasn't understanding and listening to my voice. So therefore, I'm going to do my own thing and continue to grow my platform to speak to the voices that I'm fighting so hard for to speak to at Refinery. And so, yeah, we created this safe space for us. We had phenomenal speakers come out. We actually had the co-founder at that time of Refinery 29, Pierre, love her, who actually came out to speak at that event to teach women about what it's like to launch a media company. What are the steps that you need to do? We've had the editor-in-chief of The Cut now, Lindsay Peoples.
Yes.
She was one of the speakers there. And we've had directors at GQ. We've had so many amazing founders of Ethel's Club, etc. Like, so many amazing Black and brown brilliance come speak at these events, because what you realize is there's a huge space where, like, so much information is not being shared.
Yeah.
And there's a huge disconnect. So it's like, if you can find the ones who broke it down, they got it right in life, they figured out what the key was inside the door, I want to connect those who don't have the resources, don't have the access. I want to bring them together. So that's exactly what this event does, right? And we're so focused and we're so adamant about helping Black and brown people advance in their careers.
So let's talk about the logistics of it all, because yes, you had a network and you felt comfortable asking key influential luminaries to come and speak, but like the logistics of event production is no joke. Did you have any help? Had you ever created an event like this before? Was that overwhelming? Was that something that you felt like, oh, I got this? Tell me about that first event.
It was incredibly overwhelming and scary.
Because also, like, again, you have a full-time day job, so.
A full-time job. And I was like, why am I doing this? What am I getting myself into?
Like, did you have sponsors?
So the first event in 2017, I used my savings to host the first event.
Oh, wow.
I had no investors. I had no financial support. Didn't have people dishing out money to me. Nothing. I had literally used my savings. And I remember being like, I made no profit from this. When you host events, specifically in the beginning, like you are funding a lot of the upfront costs, because in order to have supporters or investors, you have to have proof of success, right? Proof that you've done this, something to show for, like anything else, like a job. You have to have proof. And so I kind of went in knowing that. And so I was very careful with the way that I spent my money, and I had saved a lot before coming into this event. And so it was challenging. We had 200 people show up, and I thought it was going to be like 150.
Wow.
And so we had 200 people. We had this brunch place in Manhattan. It wasn't that big. And so we didn't have a lot of space. We had people up on the rooftop, people inside, people outside. There were like 50 people outside. The restaurant was like, oh my God, you're overflowing. This is not what we signed up for. And it was a lot of chaos. But I will say I did have a supportive group of interns, and I had two other contractors helping as well. And so that really helped us bring together the event. But I think the most important thing to when you're having an event is funding the event, right? And then also knowing the people to have as speakers. And I think that's what made Sip and Slay so special, is that we were able to bring such amazing luminaries that you mentioned to come and speak, whereas like you would have no access to these people any other way, right? Like I think about when I was 20 and 19, how would I have heard from the editor-in-chief of Teen Vogue? And so for us, it was like, great, like we are a Black community. We're pushing this message out to the Black community for them to come hear these people speak. But yeah, it was incredibly difficult and expensive. And I'm just so thankful now to the sponsors that we do have and the community that we do have for our Sip and Slay events. And that didn't come, I do want to say, with business. That has not come overnight. Like that definitely took like 3 years to build too.
I mean, thank you for that transparency, because I do think that everyone, you know, they see success and they think, oh, it just happened overnight. But to be honest about the fact that, you know, I talk about it a lot with building Who, What, Where, like I was broke for a long time. Like we didn't have advertisers. There was no money coming in. Again, it's that proof of concept that you're talking about. And 3 years to build something, that's a long time. That involves patience and, you know, having that belief in what you're doing. But it seems like everything continued to grow as you went forward. So that obviously had to be encouraging, right?
100%. And we went from New York City to having Sip and Slays in LA, DC, and New York City. And then due to quarantine, we went from having, you know, a domestic audience to having a global audience and having 600 people tune into our event instead of 200 in person. So everything happens for a reason.
Yes. Okay, let's go back. So now it's 2018. And you left Refinery, and then you started as a social media editor for New York Magazine's The Cut, which is just a dreamy, dreamy job. So I'm sure that a lot of the folks listening are familiar with your incredible work there, but you just did such an amazing job. I mean, your wit and the commentary, it was just so, so great. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you got that job, how you knew it was the right one for you, and what it was like fully moving into social.
Shout out to India Brown. I just want to put that out there, because India saw the potential in me when I didn't even see it in myself. India is now an editor at Who, What, Where. Make sure you check out her articles. But at this time, she was working at The Cut, and I had met up with her for lunch. I had just left Refinery at this time, and I was telling her, like, you know, I'm focused on me. I'm finally ready to take ESG to the highest level, and like, these are all the incredible plans, and maybe we want to launch an app, and this is the next step, and all this. And she was like, wait, I actually brought you here to tell you that we're hiring at The Cut and we're looking for a social editor. And I think you could be great for the role. And I looked at her and I was like, I don't think so, India. I really don't think so because I've never ran social media for a company. I said, Hillary, like I did a little for the New York Times, you know, I didn't do any social at Refinery, really. And she was like, wait, no, Nana. You built a company off of Instagram. Are you kidding me? Yes, you have social media experience. Yeah. Yes, you can be an editor. Are you kidding me? I was like, wait, you're right. I can do that. Why am I limiting my own possibilities for my life? And so it happened so quickly, to be honest with you. India CC'd me on an email with Stella, the editor-in-chief at that time. And they set up like 4 interviews with me and I met Stella and we just connected. She's just incredibly down to earth, very interested in unique points of views, which I was too as well. She wanted a voicey person. I'm very voicey. And, you know, she wanted someone that wasn't afraid to shake the table a little bit. And at that moment, that's really what I wanted to do. I wanted to shine a spotlight on these amazing Black voices in the space that I felt like we're not getting the exposure that they deserved. And I wanted to be punchy and I wanted to educate an audience that wasn't familiar with the topics I knew about and all of that. And we just had a great conversation and we clicked. And so funny, she goes, when can you start? And the social director was like, ah, so hold on, we gotta give her an edit test first and then we can see from there. But like, we just really connected and I love Stella till this day for just seeing that light in me, right? And giving me that opportunity. Cause like I mentioned, I'd never been a social editor before. I did launch Every Stylish Girl on social media though, but not for like a traditional publisher. No, I had not been.
I mean, that's kind of amazing. So tell me about what it was like to start there. I mean, like the other part about like, yes, voice and taste and point of view and having an eye and all of that stuff is super important. And obviously you had a deep understanding, I'm guessing, of like the analytics side of things. But it's still like there's a lot of data involved and you were able to grow the following tremendously. So I'm wondering, what was a learning curve for you? What did you already feel like you knew? And what were sort of those first 6 months like?
So I want to first state that I was hired as the first Black person on the social team at The Cut. And I didn't know about that until a little bit later on. But what I learned was that you really have to understand the tone of a company and their morals beforehand. Like, this is social media 101. Even though I had all this uniqueness, all this fun flavor I wanted to bring, I kind of had to dial that back a little bit in the beginning just to bring like a smooth transition to the page and to just introduce myself. And so what I did was I set up meetings with Stella and the rest of the editorial team. I created a Cut Bible to help guide, you know, the next social person in the role, but to also keep me on track too as well, because I did have some struggle moments when I came in a little bit too hard. And
what does that mean?
Right. So pretty much what that means is like the audience didn't know I was Black. The audience assumed I was white. So when I did a post about a Black celebrity's braids and beads, and I put in the caption, who remembers these days when we used to like put braids and beads in our hair, like Throwback Friday, right? I got a lot of backlash. I got a lot of Black women in the comments angry. Like, is this cultural appropriation? Like, who's writing this caption? White women shouldn't be doing cornrows with bees. Like, that started the Black community. This is the history of it. And I remember like freaking out because I'm like, wait, I'm being attacked by my peoples. Like, what's going on here? And I had to meet with Stella and like, I had to understand that Nana, like, they think you're white. And I didn't think about that when I first started the position.
Right.
And so I remember Stella saying to me, like, let's introduce you to our audience. Let's make them familiar with who's running this account and let's show your face, show yourself. Oftentimes social editors are behind the scenes. No one really knows who's running the account. But I think coming into The Cut, I realized that it is so important to know who runs your company's account, right? It is so important to, you know, use first person if you want once in a while and be very voicey so people understand you. And social media should feel like you're talking to your best friend. It should not feel robotic. It should not feel like you're talking to a public. And so I remember after that had happened and I got dragged, I went on the Cuts Instagram, I introduced myself. I did a video, I did a takeover, and I used to sign off my captions and say, written by your Black social editor, Nana, peace out. Like, I used to really, like, put it out there because I'm like, y'all not about to drag me. And we're going to have it real clear, like, whose voice is here? Who's running this, right? Like, yeah. I am bringing newness here. I'm bringing diversity here. And, like, I'm here to represent us, right? So I wanted that to be very clear on what my intentions were. It's so funny because I'm just like, I brought so many Black women to the Cut. Like, so much of the Black community started following the Cut after I started working there. And so I think it goes back to showing, like, the importance of revealing who runs the account, having them share a little bit about their story too as well, if you're making that, like, transition and having that be your first Black editor of the account. I think it's important to let the audience know what's happening. I definitely had some difficult points there, but I think once I made that very clear, I got very comfortable with my voice. I got very comfortable with speaking with the audience on there, and I just was myself 100%. And you can see that in my Met Gala coverage from 2019, where I was very loud and I was very much so myself on the red carpet, cracking up jokes, and we went viral that day. So it's important to be yourself. Don't feel like you have to change for anyone else or any other publication.
So tell me about what your day-to-day was like, because the reality is, like, I work really closely with our social team. I often worry about them just because it's a lot to be that online for work. And, you know, you have to be the first on breaking news. You are ingesting a lot of feedback. It just feels like dealing with a tidal wave at all times. Did you find that tiring or invasive? Did that feel exciting to you? Where was your head? What was your day-to-day like? And sort of what were some of the good parts and bad parts about that job?
Going into it, I didn't understand how exhausting it was going to be. I didn't understand how much of a full-time investment you make when you decide to take on the responsibility as a social editor for a company. And one thing to realize is that it's not a post-and-go situation. It's never.
No.
So for us, the social editors started around 7, 8 a.m. every day. Most people in media start around 9 or 10. So you're starting 2 hours earlier. The reason why is because you have to be on the lookout for breaking news. You have to be the first to everything. But not only do you have to be the first to everything, you also have to be accurate on what you post. And I think that is what is difficult in this role, is that timeliness is so important and so relevant, but language and copy is just as relevant. So sometimes I would struggle with that, and I'd be so quick to get something up, especially during the elections, where I wanted to be timely, I wanted to be on top of things, but I didn't realize that I had to cultivate my copy in a particular way so it wasn't offensive to our audiences, right? Because everyone has so many different views. So that to me was such a challenge. So you get up, you're on the news, 7, 8 a.m. You're reading, I would say, about like 2 hours. You're looking at other publication competitors. You're just looking at hard news. You're kind of figuring out what your stories need to be for that day. You know, Hillary, I go hard in everything that I do. And so typical editors, probably like for news publications, are maybe posting about like 3 times a day. I was posting 5 to 7 times a day, right? And so when we talk about how I grew the Instagram 80% growth rate and how I doubled them from 500,000 to 1 million in a year, that's what it took. It was going above and beyond, not posting 3 times a day, but posting 7 to 5 times, right? And making sure each of those posts performed. And if they didn't, delete them and find something else that's going to perform.
Yep.
And so for me, it was, you know, figuring out what my social day would look like. What would I be posting that day? And then it was figuring out what are the articles being published that day, right? What time are they going out? How can I get them together? And then it was creating the copy. So that's the most important part. And we do not actually have copy editors for social. And so we would have to kind of, like, I had to bring that voice. I had to bring everything to that table.
Wow.
I had to make sure grammar and, like,
had to bring that M dash.
Oh my God. Yes. Everything. And so, like, when you're trying to be quick, sometimes that can be a little challenging. But I had such a supportive team. Once again, shout out to India. She was my little copywriter. I would send it to her and be like, hey, can you just, like, check over this, make sure it looks good? And she had been working at that company for so long. This is why it's important when you go to new companies, befriend the people that have been there for a few years so they can give you information on the back end and just things to stay away from, be careful of.
Institutional knowledge.
Institutional knowledge. I love it. And so she used to tell me, hey, we do not write about this person. Hey, we don't cover this. Hey, we don't use that word. We don't talk about this. I was like, oh my gosh, there's so many rules. I didn't even know about this.
But good to know those guardrails.
Exactly. Like every publication has its own preferences for certain things. And so just knowing all that was really, really helpful. And then throughout the day, I would just post, or read. And then obviously when New York Fashion Week came about or events, I was in person. And I think that's one thing people skip over with social editors is not only that you're on your phone, but you're actually capturing the content a lot of time. You're going to events, you're interviewing people at events, you're getting photos and videos too as well, right? Because
yep.
you have to post them on Instagram stories. It's not just about in feed.
No.
So oftentimes I had to interview prep and really get that together too for social. And so it was an amazing experience. My favorite job I've ever had in my life. It made me to who I am today. It made me so strong. It made me so witty. It made me so knowledgeable about so many aspects of this world and how different people think. I've never worked for a majority Black publication, but I think it's so interesting to work for a publication that is so focused. You know, majority is like white, upper middle class women, right? And so yeah. you learn so much. You learn their interests, their dislikes, what they talk about, what they don't. And one thing I realized, it was like a lot of Black women share those same, right? That same humor.
Yeah.
And I think it was beautiful to see that synergy in certain moments and certain points. And like, we all get this joke. And I would post something, I'm like, are they gonna get it? And everyone got it. I was like, yes, I love this. So I think those were such beautiful moments. And it made my job so worth it to see the success and growth over the time.
So you're still doing Every Stylish Girl during all of this. At what point were you like, okay, I want to pivot. I want to do this full time.
During the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020, I realized that this wasn't my calling. Working for someone else wasn't my calling. And I'll never forget during my last months of working at The Cut, I had interviewed Gabrielle Union. And I was just speaking to her and I was like, oh, what made you like launch a clothing line and then do all this stuff? I'm like, you're a phenomenal actress. Why did you want to start all these other companies? And she was like, you know what? If you don't get invited to a seat at the table, create your own table. And that really spoke to me because I'm like, you're right. Like, why am I waiting to be editor-in-chief of someone else's company when I can just build my own table? I can build my own company and I could fill that freaking table up with all Black women. And like, that is what I wanted to do. And that's what I was passionate about. And that's what I was devoted to. And that's what drove me every day, right? To get out of my bed and do what I have to do. And so it was just thinking about that conversation, thinking about that quote, watching the news, looking at the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement. I was needed. I was needed more than ever, right? In that moment. And so when I had left The Cut, before that, I had launched a sister company to Every Stylish Girl called Every Stylish Girl Biz, which is a platform that provides career consultant grants and visibility to Black-owned businesses. And a huge part of our company is that we launch a global directory of women who specialize in beauty and fashion that recruiters can hire. And this was so vital to this moment because during this movement, you heard a lot of companies sharing their data and statistics around diversity and inclusion and their numbers around their executive team and their employees. And a lot of them were under 3% for diversity. So I knew that there was a lack of representation in those spaces. And I knew I had a phenomenal network of Black and brown women to fill those jobs and opportunities. So all of that happening, all of that same moment, I realized I gotta leave The Cut. As much as I am so in love with this brand and so moved by it and the mission and the storytelling, I gotta create my own table. And so, yeah, launched a directory, created my own table, left The Cut in that order.
I mean, that is a massive movement. How was it received? How did you feel about it? What was it like?
It was incredibly emotional.
Yeah.
Transitioning from a company that you felt really unwanted at and coming to a company that praises you and admires you and loves you for all your talents.
Yeah.
You feel wanted, and that's the best feeling. That's the feeling anyone wants at the job that they work at, right?
Yeah.
And so it was so hard for me because I'm like, what if I have to find another job? What if ESG doesn't work out to be what I want it to be? What am I going to do? And I remember speaking with Stella and like crying because she's like, can you not do both? Is there anything we could do? Like, we want you to stay. Like, you're amazing to this team. And I remember being like, I can't. I gotta pursue my own passions. And that was such a difficult conversation for me. And we found a way to, like, keep me on as a contributor. But it was such a difficult conversation because I finally felt wanted in my career. I'd been working in for 6+ years. I had never felt that way before, like I did at The Cut. And so it was really, really difficult.
And there's also stability, too.
That was a huge part. As I mentioned, I didn't know what the future was. No one does when they launch a small business. Yeah. No one knows what it's like. It's such a huge risk that you have to take. But I knew if I didn't take it now, I probably wouldn't take it again, to be honest with you. And I'd always have it at this, like, hustle, side hustle thing. And it wasn't. It was much larger than that. And I owed it to my community of 100,000 to show up for them, right? I owed it to them, to be there for them, to help them and support them during this super exhausting time that we're going through. And so, yeah, it was incredibly difficult to leave, but it was the happiest thing I've ever done, the best decision I've ever made.
Did you have any sort of, like, financial plans of, like, okay, I have this much saved, you know, because you have your own personal brand, you also have the company, like, you have multiple revenue streams.
Right. Yeah. So you hit it all. I have multiple I have multiple revenue streams. It's 100% a privilege to leave your company and work for your own company full time.
But you had proof of concept.
Once again, I had proof of concept. And I had, mind you, I had been running Yeshi for this time 4 years. This is not something I launched a year before. I've been running it 4 years, going into 5 years. I felt very confident to say that, okay, I could leave and I could at least handle the next 6 months, right?
Yep.
And so I think for me, it was just trusting in myself and having that proof of concept to say, like, it's okay. It's okay to leave. Trust yourself. Trust your gut.
So let's also talk about your ebook, Social Media Tips I Wish More People Knew About, which launched in June. So this is full of your best secrets, from growth strategy to engagement tips to help people create their dream career in this ever-growing digital landscape. When did you start thinking about putting all of these tips together in a book? How did you come up with them? Can you share any? And where should people buy it?
So right after I left The Cut, obviously I had so many questions about how I got The Cut to a million. What did I do? What were my resources? What were my tips? What were my tools? I was like, why don't I just put this all in a book? Because I was able to launch 4 successful companies, including my own, in the past 5 years, that are all very profitable, doing incredible things, have such engaging communities. I need to put this information out there because I cannot be the only one out here winning. We all can win together. Yep. And so I put this in an ebook, and I really talk about the importance of the 3 E's, which is every piece of content that you post needs to either be educational, engaging, or exciting. And so those are some of the tips that I go into the ebook, and really how to launch a successful brand, whether you're a small business owner, you're a full-time entrepreneur, you're an influencer, your personal brand, or your company's brand. Like, it is definitely doable. And I hope that these tips can be applied to anyone's small business or brand to use. I've used them to help me create a separate income for my personal brand. And I've used them towards The Cut to get them to a million. And you can purchase the ebook at link in my bio at It's Really Nana or on everystylishgirl.com.
So you have done so much in your career already, even though you're still in the early days, which is just so wild to me. I'm curious if you have made any mistakes thus far that you want to talk about, that you have learned from, because I think it's important to not just give people the Instagram highlight reel from success to success story, because while that's part of it, the reality is, you know, we all make mistakes along the way, and the way we hire, how long we stay in jobs, all of those things. So I'm wondering if you can tell us about a mistake that you've made and something that you've learned from it.
I think for me is not letting intimidation make me afraid. Like, I was definitely intimidated by the industry. There were so many times that I went to pitch certain opportunities and I was like, I don't feel like they're going to like my idea. So I would put that away and find another pitch friendly idea or thought. And like I mentioned, I just wish I was myself earlier, my inner self earlier, and not put up this facade of someone that I thought the industry wanted. Because I realized my true talents and what I showed at The Cut paid off far beyond than things in my earlier year in life. So for anyone who's listening, create a plan for yourself. I like to talk about the 5 to 10 year plan all the time. And this is just planning what you want for yourself, accomplishments that you want to achieve in the next 5 to 10 years. Start at a week, you start at 3 weeks, 2 months, 3 months, 5 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, etc. And this is really important because it provides you clarity about your career and what you want. And so you don't get easily deterred and you don't get distracted and you can really, you know, stay on path. And I wish I would have known that secret earlier on in my career so I could kind of stay on path and do what I wanted, not what outside people wanted me to do, not what I thought the industry wanted me to do, right?
Right. A lot of our listeners are folks who are in their first lives, and they might be interested in changing lanes, whether that's within an industry or going from corporate to working for themselves, whatever it may be. But they feel a little bit nervous about making that change. What advice would you give someone who wants to start their second life but just hasn't quite done it yet?
To be honest, I think the first step is just making sure that you have that financial stability. I think it's so important because money talks, unfortunately, in the world that we live in. And so before you make this transition, just make sure you are okay. Your family is going to be okay. You have that support you need, or you've saved up to do what you want, and start. Like, I think that is really the most important thing. I think, you know, we posted this quote on Every Stylish Girl today, and it was like, you don't need another course. You don't need another opinion. You don't need another program. You don't need to research more. You just need to start. And I truly think that is the first step in doing anything. It's just starting. Have you started yet? Are you still jotting your notes down? Are you still reading the book about what you need to do? Right? And it's just like, just take that first step.
So my last question is also my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with your younger self and give yourself a little career advice, what would you say?
I'm going to go back to that quote I said before with Gabrielle Union. Don't wait for someone to invite you to their table. Make your own table. Yeah. I think I spent so much of my career wanting to be that editor-in-chief of a big traditional publication, where I could have been the editor-in-chief of my own publication, right? Like, of my own life, of my own company. Don't wait for someone else to build that for you. You can do it.
Nana, I love that. Thank you so much. Oh my gosh, this was such a delight.
Thank you.
That was the founder of Every Stylish Girl, Nana Adjemine. For more inspiring interviews with women like Nana, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you're interested in hearing from on the show, so send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show's at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car right in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.